With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. Are you a shrewd Samaritan? On today's show, we answer the question of what causes poverty and how you can be the most effective at helping others.
I'm an American. Red, white, and blue. And I'm a citizen of this world and of heaven. So things were meant to be together. I believe in faith and freedom. Got a country too. I believe with faith and freedom. We're gonna make it through.
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time.
We gotta stay strong, 'cause everything's on the line. We gotta rise up, we gotta stay strong to save our way of life.
As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have Bruce Weidick. Bruce is the professor of economics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and a research affiliate at the University of Notre Dame. He most recently wrote a fabulous book called The Shrewd Samaritan: Faith, Economics, and the Road to Loving Our Global Neighbor. So welcome, Bruce.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's great to be with you.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. Your book starts off with this comment. You want to help those experiencing poverty, disease, and violence, but you don't always know where to start. You feel a mixture of helplessness and guilt as you consider how to share your resources with others in need. When you volunteer in your community, contribute to a nonprofit organization, or go on a humanitarian mission overseas, you feel good about what you're doing, but you still wonder if it makes a difference. So tell us, what is a shrewd Samaritan?
A shrewd Samaritan is somebody who has learned to love their both their proximate neighbor and their global neighbor, not only with their heart, but with their mind as well. A shrewd Samaritan is somebody who engages with the needy in ways that promote their human flourishing and even their own human flourishing. So that's what a shrewd Samaritan is.
So I will tell you, I have never seen so many vagabonds at the edge of the highway as we've seen in the last like 10 years. In my lifetime, there have always been homeless people, but you had to go to Philadelphia or a big city to find them. And now I was driving recently through mid-Missouri, and there were people at Kingdom City. And what's odd to me is they all are holding up signs like, is that's the sign of a beggar. You have to stand there and it's got to be on cardboard. The most recent phenomenon is almost all of the signs say they're veterans. It makes you wonder. It makes me wonder, at least, why is there in the nation's most wealth, in the world's most wealthy nation, why are we seeing a proliferation of beggars now more than ever? And I would love to stop and ask if they're legit, but the problem is that would tie up traffic. I do believe there's a case for asking a few questions before just dumping money on everybody, But give us your perspective. I would like to hear why there are so many people begging today.
Well, that's a great question, and it's one of the things that I do talk about in the book. Actually, where we are in San Francisco, I don't think there is many homeless as a percentage of the population anywhere as much as here. And what's interesting is that homelessness is a manifestation of poverty that is unique in that it's caused by prosperity rather than poverty. Which is ironic. In poor countries, you don't see nearly as many homeless people as you do in the United States.
I think you're right. I just interviewed a guest, Rick Nelson, who was a missionary in Africa. And that was the jaw-dropping moment in the middle of the interview when he said when he was in the Congo, he never saw homeless people. They've got poverty, they're a third world country, but they're not homeless because they have connections. And here in America, it seems like I'd like to ask questions like, where's your mother? Where's your father? Where are your children? Where's your church? What kind of problems do you have that nobody else wants to help you? So go into that a little deeper. Help us understand that.
Sure. Well, it's caused by prosperity. So, for example, in San Francisco, you have this booming tech industry that's drawing in people from all over the country. And then you have government regulating housing so that the market isn't really allowed to keep up with the demand for housing that exists, especially housing at the less expensive end. And so there's a ladder of housing with the housing that exists, where when new people move into an area to take expensive to take high salary jobs, they jump on the housing ladder, and then the people on the bottom of the housing ladder fall off. And that's essentially what you're seeing in places like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, even in the Midwest. Is that the prosperity of certain regions is drawing people in. Housing isn't allowed to keep up with the demand for housing. And so the result is you see people that are homeless, even a lot of people that are working.
Really, I've not seen that. But you'd think they'd move out of California to a place where they can afford a house.
Yeah, that's the question that a lot of people ask. And it works like this. For a lot of people that are experiencing homelessness, they actually have, even though they're homeless, they have a lot of connections that allow them to, that act as a safety net. So it's relatives, friends, and so forth in a place like San Francisco. So they might have a choice of moving out of San Francisco and to a place where they might be able to afford a very, very inexpensive apartment outside an expensive city like this. But what that means is that they would lose their social connections that allow them to survive, which they have in San Francisco. And so this makes it very, very difficult for them to move out. And in fact, they're almost choosing to be homeless in San Francisco rather than maybe have a chance at a home in a less expensive place, because they feel that, you know, that losing their friendships and social safety net would be too much for them.
Well, here in Missouri, when I read stories about San Francisco homelessness, I'm reading that they actually poop on the street, which is beneath the character. It's now a character issue. Is that true, or is it just a bunch of hype?
No, I've actually seen evidence of that. I think part of the problem is there's just there, you know, homelessness has increased from, you know, in this period where San Francisco has an unemployment rate now that's close to 2%. I think it might even be less than 2%. So very low unemployment rate. Homelessness has actually increased from about 7,500 people sleeping on the streets at night a couple of years ago to about 9,500 this year. And there aren't restrooms for people. So it's partly a character issue, but it's just a question of there aren't facilities for that many people. And so, you know, we see tents lined up in parks with, you know, the words written on them, where should we go or where do we go? And it gives you a sense of empathy for these folks that they can't leave, they can't stay. It's really a tragic situation.
Do you think part of it starts with the foundational understanding of the role of government, that you've got a population of people who are asking the government to do something for them instead of feeling empowered to do something for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a role for government in some respects, but I think that governments really don't have a very good understanding of the problem to begin with, and the problems are multifaceted. They're veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. They're the working poor. There are different kinds of homeless people. They're the working poor. They're people with mental illness, right? And as a society, you know, we believe that we should care for people like veterans and people with mental illness, but we're not, as a society, we're not doing an adequate job of that. The churches do a lot, but could do more. And as a society collectively, certainly we could do more.
What are the six I's?
So in the book, I talk about the six I's, which are stages that all of us go through, or many of us go through, in terms of our relationship with our global neighbor, in terms of our willingness and ability to engage effectively with our neighbor in need, either domestically or globally. And so the first stage is just one of ignorance. Like, I just don't know about people on the other side of the world that are in need. Or maybe I don't even know about people on the other side of my town that are in need. And you know, when we get older, usually we move past that point. Sometimes we stay ignorant about these things, or we choose to. But most of the time we move on to a stage where we understand about those things, but we're pretty indifferent toward them. Or at least, like, we may not say we're indifferent toward them, but practically we're indifferent toward them. We're so concerned with our own lives and our own families and the plight of our favorite Netflix character and our favorite sports teams that the needs of the global poor, or the poor even in our communities, are just, they're just on the back burner somewhere. I deal actually with a lot of people that are at stage three, which is idealism, where it's like, we're not ignorant and we're not indifferent. We're idealistic. And a lot of Christians are in this stage. Like, we want to do something. We hear about these problems, terrible problems on the other side of the world, or terrible problems even in our own city. And we just have to do something. We need to do something just to alleviate ourselves of this guilt that we feel of being people of prosperity in the midst of poverty, or at least when we're aware of poverty. But the problem is, in this idealistic stage, we don't have any sense of cause and effect. You know, what can we actually do that will help somebody? You know, what can I do as a Christian believer that will actually help somebody and not just make me feel better? The fourth stage is investigation, which is where we actually learn about these issues. Like, for example, like, we were just talking about homelessness. You know, what actually causes homelessness? We can't understand what to do about something like homelessness unless we understand what causes it. And so an investigation is when we have the patience to actually learn about people experiencing homelessness, or learn about people in the triangle countries in Central America, in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and why are they fleeing their countries in the first place? Like, what are the root problems? And we can do that through to some extent through popular media, but even more through going to places or reading scientific papers or going to conferences and really understanding what the issues are. And so the fourth stage is investigation. The fifth I call introspection, which is when, you know, we understand maybe things that will help our global neighbor or our domestic neighbor, but they have to line up with our own natural gifts, or even spiritual gifts and talents and places that we feel called to. And so in the book, I talk a lot about this, like how to find our own callings in terms of engaging global poverty, and where those line up with the needs, and when those line up, that's where we see impact, which is the sixth I. And that's where we see fruitful, meaningful, and effective engagement with global poverty.
Well, the Bible is full of places where it says we're supposed to help poor people. the problem a lot of Christians have in our country is finding poor people who are truly poor and making sure that our gifts are legitimately helping instead of hurting. In fact, there was a book written one time called When Helping Hurts. Mm-hmm. Did you read that?
Yeah, absolutely. The author is a friend of mine, Brian Ficker, and Steve Corbett is the co-author. Yeah.
And we haven't had him on the show yet. We're just doing the Shrewd Samaritan first. But the point is that nobody wants to donate money to the poor if it's going to make things worse. If we're going to exacerbate the situation, create more Yes. codependency, or worse than that, if we make them deeper, if we enable them to go deeper into an attitude of dependency on us instead of dependency on God. The biggest problem I see in America is people are dependent on government. Now they want government to bail them out of their student loans because, after all, that would be helpful, right? But no, they incurred those loans of their own free will. And it's really hard to understand how are we supposed to fulfill the mandate that we help poor people if we don't know who needs help and what kind of help they need.
Mm, yeah, that's a great question. It's I think one of the first ideas that I talk about in the book is the idea of a poverty trap. And it's I think most economists are pretty convinced that people can end up in these either virtuous cycles where they make choices that lead to better outcomes and those outcomes help them make better choices and that results in material prosperity for many people. But also you can have these vicious cycles instead of virtuous cycles where maybe somebody made a bad choice way back down the line, or maybe even somebody's parents made a bad choice. And that leads to a bad outcome, which causes people to make more bad choices or more kind of suboptimal choices, which leads to worse outcomes, which lead to more bad choices. There's some really interesting research that's been done in behavioral economics, which shows that just your average everyday person who lives in material prosperity, if they don't eat, for example, they don't have enough food and they don't know where they're going to sleep this next night. Essentially, the human brain just focuses on these basic needs so much that it actually causes people to make bad decisions. just being the overriding concern with getting food and getting shelter causes us to make decisions that aren't very good. Or if we've experienced trauma, we want to medicate those feelings of hopelessness or helplessness. And so people take drugs, right? Which we, especially as Christians, we think of that as a bad moral choice to take drugs. And a lot of people are doing it to medicate problems of post-traumatic stress syndrome, for example, if they're military veterans that have been in combat, or if they have mental illness, or if they have severed ties with their families. And so yeah, it's this balance of compassion, but yet tough love. In many cases, an effective interventions rather than just enabling interventions. That's what this book is about.
So, what is the root cause of poverty
in the United States or globally?
Mm-hmm. Well, give us both. I'd like to hear about both of them.
Sure. Yeah, I have in the book. I have a chapter on each. So let's talk about global poverty first. So, obviously, you know, this is like a 2-hour lecture that I would give my students that I'll try to condense like into a minute. But they're different. Really good research has pointed to different reasons about why rich people are rich and poor people are poor across the globe. Some of it has to do with geography and why certain areas like Europe were more became prosperous quicker. And why the Industrial Revolution took off in places like Europe sooner than other places. And there are a number of books I could refer people to that are interested in that. Other research points to culture, that there's something about certain cultures that just lead to material prosperity. For example, the aspirations to succeed, to get ahead, certain aspects of Protestant Christianity, for example, like way back, people like sociologist like Max Weber correlated with prosperity, a belief in property rights, like, you know, you shouldn't steal, you should honor what the property of your other neighbor, you know, sort of basic cultural ideas like this tend to lead to prosperity. Other people, and probably the most in the economics profession, the thing that we point to the most are just the rules of the game that different societies create for themselves. So like where the, and we call those institutions. And so if the rules of the game in a country foster economic prosperity, you'll probably find economic prosperity. Where the rules of the game don't foster that, for example, like in many in countries, say like Cuba or North Korea, where or other places where there's a lot of corruption, where the rules of the game facilitate people taking what others have created rather than creating yourself, then you often get poverty. So it's probably a combination of those different things.
I found that out when I was trying to buy vanilla. Anybody who bakes in America can tell you that a few years ago you could buy vanilla for a quarter of the price you can buy it for now.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know if you want to, if you are familiar with what happened over there in Africa, but this country where they grew vanilla, people got greedy and started stealing the vanilla beans. So then the farmers, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is my story that I heard from my own research. The farmers started picking their vanilla beans while they're green to keep people from stealing them. And then the quality of the vanilla was horrible because they didn't let the beans ripen correctly.
You know, I know that vanilla prices have gone up, but what you say makes a lot of sense. I can't corroborate that exact story.
It was Madagascar, Africa.
Yes, actually, that rings a bell. What you're saying, though, rings true. And so let's talk about that institutions idea for a second. Basically, what you have is an inability of the government to secure property rights for people over their vanilla beans, right? And so it's a, you could think of it as like an institutional failure that allows for theft of somebody's economic property, right? And so one of the most important functions of government is to help maintain property rights for people. And when it does that well, people are able to capture the returns on their investment, for example, like a crop of vanilla beans. And so I think what you're describing is the same kind of institutional failure, kind of government failure that we would see in many countries and many different, very similar examples. So, so then if you draw the conclusions for that, if the government can't guarantee my right to harvest my own vanilla beans, then why should I plant vanilla beans in the first place? And there you have poverty, right? So I think you're onto something there.
Okay, so that's global poverty. Now about American poverty. We've got, when I see somebody on the street begging, I'm thinking to myself, how much money do the taxpayers already spend to give people housing and food stamps? We've got food pantries. We've got Medicaid. What is missing? How much higher can the tab go up? And the reason we chunk money at it is we're trying to make sure everybody has a baseline where nobody's actually there. How does that happen in America?
Sure. So there are a number of things that really good research has pointed to about why there's increasing inequality in rich countries, which is it's an undisputed phenomenon that inequality has increased both in the United States and the United Kingdom. And so let me give you a couple of the reasons. So this is what, you know, people think in economic and political science departments. Basically, you always have technological change, right? Which has been going on for forever, you know, since humanity began. And inequality essentially, or equality, is a race between education and technology. So constantly in a society, you have technology increasing, and then you have people's ability to keep up with that technology by educating themselves on how to use the technology. And people who are able to do that make a lot of money, In other words, like if I know how to program in Python and write an app that 20 million people in the world are going to download, I can make a lot of money, right? And so the internet actually accentuates this need to interact with technology. For people, but not everybody can be educated, right? And if the technology is very low, like if we're all just working with horses and plows and things like that, right? Then nobody needs very much education to keep up with our neighbor. But the more that technology advances, the more that people have to acquire the level of education that it takes to interface with that technology. And so what's happened in the United States primarily, and we can talk about globalization, which is a second reason also, is that education is concentrated really in the hands or in the lives of relatively few people. And the demand for skills of just moving an object from point A to point B, just physical labor, the demand for those skills has gone down because of robotics and other forms of technology. But the demand for people who can program that technology has gone up. And so those people are really, really productive, right? Like if you can program a team of 100 robots to carry out this, you know, moving physical objects from point A to point B, well, wow, that's really productive. You're going to make a lot of money and you're going to receive quite a bit of compensation in terms of salary to do that. Or if you own companies, stock in companies that can do that, like Amazon, for example, you're going to become a wealthy person. But if your skill is moving objects from point A to point B, and you're in a society that where there's a wide diffusion of technology, you're not going to do well. And just the fact that, for example, the people that know how to interact with that technology earn high salaries and can outbid you for the price of a house means that you're at a disadvantage, right? The technology in some ways has made you worse off because there are people in your community that know how to interact with that technology and can outbid you for that scarce housing that exists in your community. So you can see, so that fundamentally explains quite a bit of the inequality that exists in places like the United States. The other factor is globalization. So the fact that those kind of jobs, like moving an object from point A to point B, are outsourced because other people around the world can do that for less money. Their wages are lower, right? And so those jobs are what we call in economics, we call them contestable. Like somebody's job, who it is, move an object from point A to point B, that job is contestable by somebody overseas who's willing to work for a lower wage. So as we've seen in the last generation, many of those jobs have gone overseas, both because of they've either gone away because of technology, or they've gone away because people's jobs are contested overseas. But the vast majority of it is through technology rather than globalization.
I think I can tell when I'm getting a phone call from a call center in India. and it may seem, at first I'm like, well, wait a minute, how do you know you're not being prejudiced? There could be people in America with strong Indian accents. But the truth is, there are so many call centers over in India today that if you're getting a telemarketing call, chances are pretty high that that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story about that. I was in Bangalore, and I had a plane to catch at 4 a.m. And when my taxi driver took me to the airport, we passed through the streets at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, and there were all these 25-year-olds, just hundreds of them, just hanging out on the sidewalk with corporate name tags. And I asked the taxi driver, who are these people? Why are they having a party at 2:30 a.m? And they said, oh, those are just people working at call centers on their break. Because it's 8 to 5 workday in the United States, and so they work. So for the call centers, they're working in the middle of the night.
That would be about right. Yep, and they're even calling cell phones now, which is very offensive. We used to think we're so smart if we get away from our landline, that won't happen. But the point is, you're making that we can pay people to do that in other countries for way less than you can pay an American to do that. So tell us about the effective and ineffective poverty interventions. I want you to give us the impact framework for Shrewd Samaritans.
Sure. Oh, yeah. So in the book, I talk a little bit about bang for the buck, like how much good does something do, like, for example, giving somebody a farm animal overseas, mm-hmm. relative to how much it costs, or giving somebody deworming medicine to free them from worm infestation, or building a school, right? But the book actually kind of goes beyond that into something that I call bang for the buck, which is more of a biblical idea of human flourishing. And so it's not only how effective is that deworming medicine or those textbooks or whatever we're giving the needy overseas relative to how much they cost, but how much does that effectiveness of the deworming medicine actually promote human flourishing, right? So it might be, in other words, like worm medicine might do a really good job at getting rid of worms, intestinal worms, but how much does getting rid of intestinal worms actually promote human flourishing, like human beings really able to thrive? So that bang for the buck, I call B3 in the book, B3. And so in terms of different things that are effective, you know, one of the most effective interventions, both at home and abroad, are early childhood interventions. For example, just helping moms with parent at-risk moms, say single moms, that young moms, both at home and overseas, learn to be really good moms to their kids. How to discipline them correctly, how to give kids the proper kinds of food, how to encourage them in school, how to read to them, how to do all these things that really good parents do. That prevents a whole host of problems down the road. And one of the things it means to be a shrewd Samaritan is how much more cost effective it is to stop problems before they start. In other words, to prevent problems from happening in the first place, than it is to actually try to solve problems after it's all hit the fan. Later when, for example, when kids are all grown up. So knowing how to prevent problems in the first place is one of the aspects of being a shrewd Samaritan. Like, for example, the power of vaccines or very kind of early childhood inoculations for different diseases or preschool interventions, things that reach kids when they're young that prevent them from being sick later. Or from being uneducated later, or from having poor socio-emotional skills later. So one of the things that I advocate for are early childhood interventions, things like child sponsorship is actually a really, really good intervention with organizations like Compassion International. It's not the cheapest intervention, but man, does it have really big impacts on kids overseas.
But what about the role of their own parents in their lives? Aren't their own mom and dads? Wouldn't it be better to help the mom and dad and let mom and dad help their kids?
Yeah, I think like what I was mentioning about parental coaching is one example of doing exactly that, kind of equipping the moms and dads to solve their own problems in their families is a great intervention, both domestically and abroad.
So I want you to wrap up by giving us your best advice. Overall, if there's one thing you want us to take away from your book, how are we supposed to be the best shrewd Samaritans?
Sure. I think let me answer that in two ways. One is with the domestic poor, and one is internationally. So I think with the domestic poor, one of the best things people can do in terms of time, for example, and I'm thinking a little bit of seniors, like people who really want to, like their kids have left the nest and they really want to give back. And they're trying to think of like, what can I do that will actually really make a big difference in somebody's life? One of the best things seniors can do in terms of volunteering their time is to volunteer at a preschool where there are some kids that are kind of coming from at-risk families, and just spending time, this sounds really simple, but just spending time playing with those kids, with those 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, and helping them to develop socio-emotional skills, basically helping them to play well with other kids, and to develop respect and kindness toward other people. Yeah.
No, I think you're right there. And I'm going to explain a phenomenon that I've seen in America. My parents are elderly, and they get invitations every week or every month to go to a senior center, assisted living, or one of those retirement communities. I think there are a lot of elderly people who are buying into that. They're spending gobs of money. They're spending their children's inheritance on these retirement places. And then they've got nothing to give their kids or grandkids because they're all hobnobbing with people who are elderly themselves. And then they've created their own culture of all these senior centers where they're with each other, but they're not giving back to anybody when they're doing that. They're talking about how their knees hurt and how they've got arthritis and they've got high blood pressure or something and diabetes. And then they just, all they do is hang around old people all day. And how is that making the world a better place? They're not passing on a baton to anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. And I want to challenge some seniors out there. If you want to do something to make a difference, volunteer at a local preschool, or maybe your church runs a preschool or something like that, or even like a daycare, and just sit with little kids and play with them and ask the preschool teacher. They'll think you're an angel sent from heaven, for one thing, but ask the preschool teacher for the kid that's the most difficult, or one of the kids that's the most difficult, and just sit and play with that kid and help to learn that kid to play well and just love on that kid, or maybe a few kids. This is something that science shows makes a huge difference. And the interesting thing is that senior who's doing that may not see the difference in the child just then. But what science says is that it's at that age when kids' brains are being formed and they're learning how to relate to the outside world. And that investment that you make in a child's life at that age starts to show up when they're teenagers. They start to respond to other people better. They start to become more trustworthy. They start to relate to people in a more responsible, socio-emotional way. And so you kind of have to trust the science with this one, but that's a wonderful use of people's time. In terms of money, one of the best things people can do is to sponsor either children directly through an organization like Compassion International or Food for the Hungry, or to give to these very cost-effective health interventions. Vaccines, deworming, mosquito nets, things like that are really, really effective. Those are probably the best ways that people can choose to help others.
That's really helpful. And I appreciate you being with us today. I hope that your book goes long and far and makes a difference in the way people donate. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's great to be with you today.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.